We continue the shiur in Gemara. Gemara says there's a pasuk in Tehillim. L'tzion yamar ish va'ish yulad ba hu yichorneha elyon. That means that Hashem says about Tzion, which is Eretz Yisrael, a man and a man who is born there, he will eventually be elevated when the Shiach comes to great height and glory. Gemara says, what's meant by a man and a man? A man who's born there, period. Why does it say it twice? Gemara says that Eretz Yisrael is different, l'havdil, than any other land, any other country. The nature is that a person born in a certain country considers himself that type of native. He is born in England, he is an Englishman. He's born in France, he's a Frenchman. If he's born in France, he will not call himself an Englishman. He calls himself according to the land where land of his birth. Eretz Yisrael is different. There are two types of people, two types of Jews. A Jew who is born in Eretz Yisrael, a native born Israeli, and a Jew born anywhere else, but whose heart is in Eretz Yisrael, who lives with the thought of Eretz Yisrael, the desire to get there, and nothing else is more important in his mind as far as geographical location in the world. He might be living in America, but to him, America is at best secondary in importance. So here the Torah says, King David says, that whether a man is born there or whether a man is born elsewhere, but considers himself an Israeli, and his heart is in Israel, these two people are both alike. Both will see the Geula, the Mashiach comes, they both receive the same merit, the same credits. They are both considered Israelis. They are both considered Tzion, part of Tzion. Now, this, of course, speaks about the coming of Mashiach. This means, how can we test a person to know whether his heart is really in Israel? The way to do that simply is, if you tell somebody about some tragedy that occurred in a certain place, the person has humanitarian feelings, he feels very sad about what happened, he takes it to heart a little, and of course he's not happy about this news. But he cannot really feel the pain and the sorrow because he doesn't know the people living in that area, that city, or that country. So it's a minor feeling of sadness. If you tell someone about a tragedy that occurred in his home city, where he knows the people there, his family, relatives, all the people there, his friends, and tell him something wrong happened, something was destroyed there, that person will really cry over this tragedy. Now here you have Jews who were not living in Eretz Yisrael, they were born in different countries, they were never in Israel, never spent much time there, and yet tell a Jew, remind a Jew about the suffering of Eretz Yisrael at the hands of its enemies, they feel just as badly as one in Eretz Yisrael who sees the Churban Beit HaMikdash. He cannot approach the area of the Beit HaMikdash. He sees this is in the hands of the Goyim. He sees how desecrated this place is. The person there can feel the tragedy in his heart better because he sees it. Yet a Jew living elsewhere, a remote point of the globe, has that same feeling of sadness, same feeling of remorse over what occurred in the Churban Beit HaMikdash. This Jew is a son of Tzion. So about both of these, the Torah says, whether he is born there, or whether he looks forward and anticipates with relish the thought of being there, going there, living there, these two are alike in the eyes of Hashem. And the Gemara adds, let's compare the Jew, an Israeli living in Israel, and one living in Chutzla, that's outside of Israel. Compare them mentally, sharpness. Mentally, of course, means in wisdom of Torah. The Yemeni says, Abaye says, that one Israeli is as good as two of us. Us means these rabbis are speaking in Babel, Babylon at the time, Shas Bavli, meaning those in Babel or those in any other country outside of Israel. The Israelis are much wiser. The Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael are much better in knowledge, greater Chachamim, than the Chachamim outside of Israel. And one simple reason for that is, the Gemara says that the Torah is considered to like iron, metal, steel. And if you take steel, two pieces, rub them together, they become sharpened, honed to a very sharp degree. Take a piece of metal by itself, it never becomes sharp. The same thing with Torah. If you have two people studying Torah together, no matter if one is better than the other or not, it makes no difference. But by studying together, one sharpens the other's mind. Each one sharpens the other. They can accomplish much more. A Talmid Chacham, no matter how great he is, if he learns by himself, then his learning is of not much value. He cannot really delve deeply or advance himself. And the Gemara tells us that the Talmid Chachamim in Israel were very friendly. They got along perfectly together. So they could study together and sharpen each other. But those in Bavel at the time had this disunity, disharmony, and therefore they generally studied by themselves. Now, simply, we say that one Israeli is like two of Bavel because in Israel they had two studying together, so each one was like two. In Bavel they learned by themselves individually, so you have each one is only like one. That's why the ratio was 2-1. Second reason is that if one from Israel is sharper because the Gemara says in Bava Batra that the heir of Israel itself is blessed, is endowed with a power of being machkim, giving chachmah, wisdom. The Gemara says in Kiddushin that Hashem sent a certain percentage of wisdom to the world, 10 degrees of wisdom to the entire world. 9/10 of all wisdom bestowed upon the world was sent to Eretz Yisrael. The air itself is filled with the Kedusha. The person breathing that air becomes wise. The Midrash in Eicha says that whenever an Israeli went to visit anywhere, people would gather around him just to hear him speak, to hear these gems of wisdom. That's why the Midrash says that though we, the rabbis of Bavel, rabbis of the Gemara, are great, but still one rabbi of Israel is twice as good as we are. The Gemara adds, but despite that, if one of us outside of Israel goes to Israel, then he becomes not equal to the Israelis, but twice as great as they are. Not only does he reach their degree, their height, but he becomes twice as great as they. The reason is that at that time, the Chachamim in Bavel were much sharper. That's why we have two Shas, two sets of Gemarot. Shas Bavli, the Shas Gemarot that were made in Bavel, the Shas Yerushalmi, the one made in Jerusalem, in Eretz Yisrael. And the Shas that we generally learn, all Jews learn, is Shas Bavli, much more so than Shas Yerushalmi. There are some, of course, who learn Shas Yerushalmi also. But that's only also. The main Shas, the main Talmud, the main Gemara, is the one made in Bavel, because the rabbis, they were sharper. The Gemara is arranged in a manner where we could arrive at the halacha, the final decision in law, much more easily than we could from the Shas Yerushalmi. So that the sharpness of mind, those in Bavel were sharper. Those in Yerushalayim had the advantage of an Israeli advantage of the air, which itself was filled with this wisdom. And this air, this avid is machkim. Just breathing the air makes a person wise. But when one from Bavel would go up to Israel, he would have both qualities. He'd have the air plus the sharpness of mind. And that's why he'd be able to even bypass the Israelis. That's the physical sense. Spiritual sense, the reason is simply that one living in Israel is to be very much envied. The big zechut. He's born in Israel. He's proud of it. The person was born in the land of Kedusha, holiness. He is spending his life there. Where does he live? Where does he eat? Where does he sleep? In Israel. Constantly, 24 hours a day, he breathes that holy air. He walks on the holy soil. So, of course, he's to be envied. But at the same time, there is something much higher than that. The person who lives outside of Israel and who is not well off, he's not in a financial condition where he could easily make the trip, or there are other difficulties, other barriers, obstacles that would stop him from getting to Israel. And despite this, he goes all out to overcome all these barriers and obstacles. And because of that fiery desire, that craving to get to the Holy Land, he overcomes everything and arrives there, reaches that Eretz Yisrael. That zechut is so great that he's now considered twice as good as any Israeli who was born there. Because we don't know if that Israeli who was born there would have been there if he was outside of Israel. He's born there, so he's there. Had he been outside of that and he would have had barriers to stop him from getting there, perhaps he might not have gotten there. Here we have one who was actually tested. He's not an Israeli, he's born outside of Israel, living outside of Israel. There were difficulties in getting there, and he overcame these difficulties. This person, therefore, becomes twice as great as a native Israeli. The Gemara says, to prove this, one rabbi, Rabbi Yirmiyahu, was not one of the best students in his class in Bavel. In fact, when the rabbis of the yeshiva studied Torah, Rabbi Yirmiyahu had very much difficulty in understanding what was being said. He couldn't follow well the lesson. It means he was weaker than the average. Then he went up to Eretz Yisrael, and he studied there for a long time. And there he would always refer to the wise men of Bavel as Bavlai Tipshai, those fools back there in Bavel. The ones that were superior to him before, he couldn't even follow their lessons, now he called them fools, which proves how a person can advance himself mentally in learning if he goes to Eretz Yisrael. Though he may be weak outside of Israel, he goes there, his mind becomes so sharpened, he'll become greater than all those he left behind. Which means in actual ratio, a person advances to exactly four times as great as he was. Because before he goes to Israel, an Israeli is twice as great as he is. When he gets to Israel, he is then twice as great as an Israeli, which means four times as much as he had before. This is the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, and how much every single Jew should strive with everything he has to be zocheh, to get to Eretz Yisrael. Of course, for the sake of Kedusha. A person who goes there, has to shalom with any other motive, that person cannot become part of Eretz Yisrael. That person will not be given any of the wisdom of the heir of Eretz Yisrael. That person cannot receive any Kedusha by walking in Israel. And in fact, the Torah says that the land itself will expel that person. The land refuses to absorb any aliyah of any person who comes there with the wrong intentions, without the proper respect for the holiness of the land. No matter what the person may be like, if he hasn't got that respect, that love for Eretz Yisrael, then that person is not accepted by Eretz Yisrael. Person is expelled automatically. But a person who is zochet to have this ahavat Eretz Yisrael, this love for it, there the Eretz Yisrael brings this person close. It's like a mother who brings a child very close to herself and nourishes that child with everything that is in the power of the mother. So does Eretz Yisrael give of all its blessings, fruit, to the person who comes there with the proper, pure intentions. The Gemara says there's a certain type of disease called Balei Hadata, which means a mental disease. It's a type of a leprosy of the brain. A certain type of germ gets into a person's brain, and this disease is very harmful. Now, it is so harmful, more so because it's extremely contagious. He later says that the rabbis were very careful to stay away from those people afflicted with this disease. One rabbi refused to sit close to any the area where the insects, the flies, who might carry this disease from these afflicted ones, might carry them to him, as he stayed a very remote distance from them. Another rabbi refused to sit where the air itself, the wind might carry some of that the germs through the air to him. Another rabbi wasn't that particular, but he would not enter a home where these diseased people were. Others refused to eat any food that entered their area because the food might become contaminated. It's so contagious is this disease, and it's so dangerous. He then says that Yehoshua ben Levi, one of the greatest rabbis at that time, he was, of course, an Amoreh, which means the later rabbis in the Gemara. But in his time, he was one of the greatest, or let's say the greatest. He felt that these people were being neglected. They are diseased, no fault of their own. They're stricken. Why should they lose out on the opportunity to study Torah? He would go to them, go into their homes, and sit close to them. And if it was cold, he would take a blanket and cover himself and this diseased person with one single blanket, press close together, and study Torah, without any fear whatsoever of getting this disease. His claim was, the Pasuk says about the Torah protects a person, one who studies it. So if the Torah, it brings charm, affection to the person, then it protects the person. So therefore, he said, I have no fear whatsoever. I will continue to help these poor souls in the study of Torah. Let them have a means of learning too. He spent a lot of time with them throughout his life. The Gemara says that when a time came for Yeshua ben Levi to pass away, of course, the notice is given. There's a slip given to an angel. He's told this is the name of the next person, the angel of death. This is the name of the person you must bring now, bring his soul to heaven. And the angel of death is infallible. He just about never misses, just about. But the mission is always completed. Now the angel that was told about was told in heaven, go bring the soul of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. But because of the fact that he allowed himself to risk to jeopardize his health, his life, in teaching these Balei Hadata, these diseased people, therefore, before you take his soul, give him anything he wants. Agree to any request he makes. This is the order to the angel of death. And so he descended and came before the Yeshua Levi and revealed himself. He showed himself before he took his life. The person sees the angel of death at the moment that he actually dies. Here he showed himself, and he said to the Yeshua Levi, I came to take you, but before I do, make any request you want. The Yeshua Levi said, fine. I want you to first take me to Gan Eden and show me my place. I want to see exactly where my place in Gan Eden is. The angel not agreed. He took him up as an angel. He took him to heaven, took him to Gan Eden, and on the way, he said to the angel of death, to travel with you it's frightening. The appearance of the angel of death itself can scare someone. So he said, while we're going, in order to be certain I'm not frightened out of my wits, I want you to give me your sword. That's a sword the angel of death carries, with which he takes the life of his victim. In other words, it's a whole process, how it goes about. He drops a bitter drop into the mouth of the person, and the person sees the angel of death, and then the soul comes out. The Eumenic describes this whole thing. The sword is the symbol of the weapon of death, the angel of death. So the Malach HaMavet gave Rabbi Shlomo Levi his sword, which rendered him impotent. Without that sword, he could not kill. When they get to the placing in Eden, there's a special wall there, and Rabbi Shlomo Levi looked over the wall and saw the place. He leaped over this wall into Gan Eden and said, "Now I'm safe. You cannot get me." Angel of death grabbed him over the wall to pull him back out of Gan Eden, because you can't get there without dying. You can't go through the process of death. Yeshua Levi said, "You can't take me," because, and he swore. He gave out a Shavu'ah. It's very sacred. He swore that he will not come with him. What happens then? To take him means he's going to force Yeshua Levi to break his swear. Plus the fact, additional fact, that he couldn't even take him if he wanted to, because the Yeshua Levi had his sword. So he was in a quandary, the angel of death. Meanwhile, what happened was that back at the ranch, back at home on Earth, there is no death going on. People would fall out of a window, they would land very softly, they wouldn't die. There'd be an explosion, there'd be a war going on, soldiers stabbing each other, and nothing happens. There's no angel of death, there's no death. So for a short while, there was pandemonium. Things were going wild. A voice came from heaven to solve this problem. Two problems. One, the sword, the return of the sword to the Malach HaMavet. And two, what about this Shavuah? He had sworn. A voice came from heaven. He ministers the voice of Hashem and said that let's investigate Rabbi Shlomo Levi and see if he has sworn before in his lifetime, then he has kept that Shavuah. He fulfilled what he swore. That's one thing. But if he has sworn and he has not fulfilled it, not that Hasan Shalmi broke the vow, but he had the vow removed by a chacham, that's the second thing. These are the two possibilities. He swore before in his life, he either fulfilled the vow, he made a vow and he fulfilled it, or he made a vow and he had this vow removed by a chacham. And the law of neder or shavuah is, a person should never make a vow at all. He should never swear. If he does, he cannot break that shavuah. But, which is better? He made a vow, let's say, to eat a certain type of food one day. Is it better to eat that food, and thereby fulfill his vow? Or is it better to go to a chacham? A rabbi has the power of removing the vow completely. Literally remove it as though it had never been made. By removing the vow, he now could eat it or not eat it. He's not restricted anymore. He's not bound anymore. The same as a husband can remove the vow of a wife. The difference is that if a wife makes a vow, the husband may remove the vow only on the day that he hears about this vow. If he lets it go for that day, on the next day he's powerless. He has power on that day alone. A chacham can remove a vow of any person, any time, if he comes to him and shows his regrets that he's sorry for it. The same as we had the story of Rabbi Akiva's father-in-law, who made a vow not to support his daughter, not to give her anything. Then Rabbi Akiva removed this vow from his father-in-law, Kalba Savua. This is the power that the Torah gives to a chacham, to remove the vow of a person. Now, the Yemeneh says, which is better? to fulfill the vow or to remove it. The Yemenis is certainly to remove the vow. A person who makes a vow itself is wrong. It's like building a mizbeach, an altar, for Avodah Zarah. That's bad enough. If he fulfills the vow, it's like bringing a sacrifice to Avodah Zarah. Though he's fulfilling the vow. What should he do? Remove the vow completely. Except in certain cases where it is permissible. Even if it speaks about certain types of nidanim, vows that are permissible to make. A person knows that he cannot, he hasn't got the patience to sit down and study Torah for an hour. And nothing can make him do it. If a person would give him $100 for that hour, he couldn't sit there and study. Even if it says there are nidrei ziruzin, which means a person makes a vow, and knows that by breaking a vow, as we learned before, break a vow, his children die, chas v'shalom. Worst things happen. By making a vow in a yen, he knows now he can't break it. This nidrei ziruzin, where he can now feel that he's obligated, so this vow is kedusha. It'll help him to study Torah, or to do any mitzvah which he's weak in. That type of vow is permissible, again, in certain cases. Nowadays, people are that weak that it's better not to make a vow at all. Ordinarily, a vow should not be made, except in these cases. Now, the question was, in the case of Yeshua Levi, Hashem said, investigate his case. Investigate means, of course, Hashem knows. But for the sake of those trying him now, investigate and find out, did he fulfill the vow he made, or did he have the vow removed? Now, if you find that he fulfilled the vow that he made, instead of having it removed, then the angel of death cannot touch him. He remains in Gan Eden, cannot be touched by the angel of death. If you find that he had the vow removed, which would seem to be better, as the Gemara says, he had his vow removed by a Chacham, then he's got to go back with the angel of death. This is the decision of Hashem. One that's very difficult to understand. Because after all, we learned that it's certainly better in all cases to remove the vow rather than fulfill it. Why should we say here that if he fulfilled the vow, he carried it out, then he is immune from the angel of death, he remains in Gan Eden forever without having gone through the process of death. Which, of course, is what they found. He had not had his vow, he had made vows without removing them. And therefore, he remained in Gan Eden. He was one of those who left this world without dying at all. He went straight to Gan Eden without dying. But why is this better in his case? The answer is that the same thing happened with Moshe Rabbeinu. When the angel of death, knowing that Moshe Rabbeinu was about to pass away, said to Hashem, let me go down and take his soul. Very thrilling for him. This is his greatest conquest. He waited for so long. To finally get the soul of Moshe Rabbeinu, whom he could not touch or come near, because the angel of death is also the Satan, the Yetzer Hara. And he could never get anything on Moshe Rabbeinu during his lifetime. No slightest trace of sin. At least now he can get his neshama. Hashem said to the Melech HaMavet, you cannot even get close to him as the angel of death. He's far too holy for you. Maybe Midrash says that he tried and he was driven away quickly. Had no power to come near Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, the reason is, what made Moshe Rabbeinu so great? That he was the greatest one alive in his generation. How do we test that? Because, as we said, to remove a vow, it takes a chacham. Remove the vow of an ordinary layman, and an haaretz who makes that vow. And that's the same as a husband and wife. Just as a husband rules over the wife, he has the power to remove the vow of the wife. So too, a chacham has the power to remove the vow of one beneath him. What about a chacham who has no superior? There's no one greater than him. How can he have his vow removed? It's impossible then. His vow must then be fulfilled. It shows he's the greatest tzaddik in the world. This was the case of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because he was that great, Malach HaMavet could not get near him. This, Hashem said, is a test in the case of Yeshua Levi. if he had his vow removed, that means he has a rabbi over him. He's not the greatest one alive. The angel of death could get to him. But if he never had his vow removed, though it's better to have it removed, but he couldn't get it because there's no chacham bigger than him, that means he's the greatest tzaddik alive, and the melech ha-mavet could not get close to him. This is why, since he was the greatest tzaddik alive then, there was no possibility of the melech ha-mavet to get to him. Of course, there's a slight question involved here where the Gemara says that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu at one time, swore to punish the Jews for their sins of the desert. They would have a Beit HaMikdash that's going to be destroyed. This was a swear by Hashem. Even it says, if only Moshe Rabbeinu had had that moment, and made the right move in saying to Hashem, I hereby remove your vow. I'm a chacham, I can remove your vow, and that's it. Take away that swear at vow of Hashem. We would have been saved. Question here is, if you need someone greater than you to remove a vow, how could the vow of Hashem be removed by Moshe Rabbeinu, a student? The answer is, again, that the Torah is no longer in heaven. Hashem gave the Torah to earth, and in many cases in the Gemara where a question of law arose, the question was, who's going to decide the law? Will heaven decide it or earth? The answer is the Torah is now on earth. The rabbis on earth have the power to decide any legal question. No voice in heaven can decide a legal question anymore. Hashem gave the Torah to the rabbis on earth. They are the ones to decide it. But therefore, when Hashem gave the Torah, he said to the Chacham on earth, I give the power to remove a vow. So even Kaviyachol, so we can say that Chacham on earth can remove a vow of anybody, even in heaven. Kaviyachol, a vow of Hashem, removed by Moshe Rabbeinu. In the case of Yeshua Levi, though, there's no one greater than him. And therefore, because of the fact that he was the greatest one alive, the Malachim cannot get to him, he may not get in. Second question was, what about the sword? Again, a voice came from heaven and said to Yeshua Levi, give back the sword. Why? Because it is needed for others. Not for you. You're safe. You will not be touched by it. Others are not immune to death. Death must go on until Mashiach comes, until Tchiyat HaMetim, then it comes back to life. Until that time, there must be death on earth. When Yeshua Levi heard this, of course, he was forced to get back the sword, but he felt at least safe enough that he was out of danger for him. Now this, his guide left him, the Melech HaMavet. He was left there in Gan Eden, and he found now that Eliyahu Navi took him and started to lead him to his place in Gan Eden. Eliyahu Navi called out, he cried out, make way for Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Make way for Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Make way means make room. He has a place here. The question is, why did he say it twice? The answer is that every tzaddik has his place in Gan Eden that's established for him, as there is for every Jew. But he also has, being that great, the Gan Eden that is lost by a rasha. A rasha who loses his Gan Eden, that Gan Eden doesn't go to waste. It's given to the tzaddik. Therefore, the enemy said, make way for the place of the Yeshua Levi, his place in Gan Eden, plus the place he has earned as a tzaddik to inherit the lost ones of the Rishayim. And while he was going along, he met Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal in heaven, was sitting on a throne, 13 pillows in that throne, very high throne in heaven. Yeshua ben Yochai Zal is considered one of the greatest tzaddikim of all time, and in heaven he saw a leader. Yeshua ben Yochai Zal said to the Yeshua ben Levi, are you Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? And he answered, yes, I am. He said, well, during your time, during your life, was the rainbow ever seen by people during your life? Shmuel Levi said, yes, it was. Shmuel Chayezal said, in that case, you're not that be Yehoshua ben Levi. So Yehoshua Levi was announced in heaven as the biggest tzaddik on earth, and the biggest tzaddik on earth is so great that he protects the world from this rainbow. Protects it means rainbow is a symbol that Hashem will not again bring a flood to destroy the world. Why? The world deserves this to be destroyed because of its evil deeds, because Hashem himself had made a vow that never again will he have a flood like in the days of Noah. Because of this vow, the world is saved. The rainbow is the symbol of that vow. But where there is a very holy tzaddik, whose zechut is so great that it protects the entire world, we don't need the rainbow to show us this vow of Hashem to protect the world. We don't need that vow to protect us. We have a tzaddik to protect us. Therefore, in the days of a tzaddik, the rainbow is not seen. This is what the Gemara says, in the days of Rabbi Shimon by Yochanan Zal, there was never a rainbow seen. Your case, he said, if you say there was a rainbow in your time, you are not going to be Yeshua ben Levi. Jimenez says it wasn't so. It's true that there was no rainbow in his time, but Yeshua ben Levi was very modest. He didn't want to show himself to be that great, so he said there was. What about this rainbow, the idea of the rainbow? The rainbow itself is a natural phenomena that comes about, that can be seen in the heavens only in the time of rain. That's why it's called a rainbow. Time of rain, the sky begins to clear and the sun begins to shine. This dampness shows itself in a bow of different colors. The sun's rays going through the liquid, put a glass of water in front of the sun, you'll find the rainbow too. So that this means there is rain, and then you have this rainbow. The tzaddik is one who helps the people to have their rain in the right time. The Gemara says rain by day is not pleasant. People have to travel, have to go to work. For them it's very unpleasant to be caught in the rain. So when is the right time for rain? At night, when no one is out on the road. So, in the case of a tzaddik, this pasuk Hashem gives the rain in the right time, time which is advantageous for everyone, which is at night. That's why at night you cannot see the rainbow. So there is a rainbow, but it's not seen. You have rain, you don't see a rainbow. But actually, if there was no rainbow, it means there's no rain. That would be a curse, Chas v'Shalom. It means only that it's not seen because of the fact that it's not during the time when there is sun out. In any event, the point was that Yehoshua ben Levi did protect his generation. He was that great that there was no rainbow seen during his time. The Midrash says that Rabbi Chanina bar Papa was also a very great tzaddik. He lived much later. And again, when he was about to pass away, the heavenly Malach Mavet was told, go down and fulfill his last desire. He came down, he revealed himself, and Yechmina Pepper said to the Malach Mavet, give me a postponement, additional 30 days time, so that I can spend this time in reviewing all the Gemara and Torah that I have studied. Because the Torah says, Ashrei, blessed and fortunate is he who comes to heaven with all his studies in his hand. That means he's reviewed all the Torah he has learned and comes prepared with all his knowledge. I want to have time to review all the Torah I have studied. This is his request, and it was agreed upon. The angel of death came back after 30 days. Again, he revealed himself, and this time, the Papa said to him, before you take me, I want you to show me my place in Gan Eden. So he said, good, I have to fulfill your request. He said, first, give me your sword, because you don't frighten me. But the Hamavid said, I've had experience before with that. No, sir, I don't surrender my sword to you. Srila Papa said, well, all right, let's bring this to a test. Bring a Sefer Torah. There's a Torah, Shulchan Aruch. Let's go through every single detail, every letter in the Torah, and every law that's applied to these letters, and show me one item that I have not fulfilled in my life, or one item that I broke in my lifetime, any sin I've done or any mitzvah I've not fulfilled. If you find one, I don't deserve this request. If you don't, why shouldn't I deserve it? Malach HaMavet answered, no question about the fact that you have fulfilled every detail, every iota in the Torah, but you have never spent time closely with those who are afflicted with this contagious mental disease. Therefore, you cannot be granted so big a request. That mitzvah you haven't got, and it was only that mitzvah which gave of Yeshua Levi the power to be able to demand the sword of the Melech HaMelech. Yemena says that he couldn't get this request fulfilled. When he was nistalek, there was a sheet of fire that separated his coffin from the rest of the people, the world. The sheet of fire was a symbol from heaven that he was greater than all. They couldn't be close to him until the sheet of fire paid its respects, then they could first bury him. It did not remove itself. I couldn't get close to the coffin for a while. One of the rabbis came close and said, please, for the sake of the Oli Chachamim, let us bury your coffin. Let us bury it. And there was no reply. That means the sheet of fire remained. Then he said, for the sake of your father. Again, no response. Then he said, for the sake of your own kavod. It's for your kavod to be buried this way, not one of a myth, one who passes away is to be buried. This way we cannot bury you. Then the sheet of fire moved itself and they were able to bury him. The letter says that this could not happen to anyone who failed to fulfill even the slightest letter of the Torah. Which means that the Rebbe Papa was so perfect, so complete. That's why he deserved to have this special treatment. Point is, we once mentioned this, and it's very vital to know. According to the words of Rabbeinu Zal, what is really the greatness of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? He went to these people who were physically afflicted, and he jeopardized himself. There are many doctors, not doctors, many good people, who do this for the sake of helping a fellow Jew who's in trouble. They risk their lives too. What makes this so much greater than anything in existence? The answer is that when we speak about a person whose mind is diseased, it doesn't mean a germ. It means a person whose mind is spiritually diseased. One who reads books of philosophy, Barminan, well, this is a disease that is fatal. A mentally fatal disease. And this is one where there is no cure at all. This is one where nobody can attempt to cure it, because if you speak to a person who has that poison of philosophy in his mind, you cannot cure him. You can only get that poison yourself, Chas v'Shalom. Rabbi Yeshua Levi was so great that he said, I will not let these Jews be destroyed by this. I will risk myself to teach them Torah, to show them the pure, true points of emunah, of faith, and have these people who have this malignant, fatal disease, have them receive an opportunity to be cured from this. Because he risked himself, risked not to himself physically, many Jews do that, but he risked his neshama spiritually. This was so great a zechut for himself, so big a tzaddik, that this elevated him to a point far above the greatest of malachim, above the angel of death. This is the power of the tzaddik emet.